Back on the show this morning is Julie Balke, who is a career strategist, and I love to talk to Julie on the show about things going on in the business world, get some perspective, maybe some advice on what we should or should not do in our day-to-day in the workforce world. Good morning, Julie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm here for you.
I know.
All those burning questions that keep you up all night.
Honestly, thank you, because, you know, I already don't sleep very much with this shift, so I appreciate any help I can get. So thank you, Julie.
Right.
Glad to have you back on this morning. So, you know, it's interesting. We're in this really weird place. And to give a synopsis, as if nobody knows the world we're living in right now, you constantly hear politicians say we are at an all-time low for unemployment in the U.S. We hear here in Connecticut that we've got so many jobs open. But at the same time, we also hear businesses saying, like, we are struggling to fill these positions. You have people saying, I don't feel incentivized to stay at the job I'm in right now. I feel like I should jump ship. We're in this weird place in America. Would you agree, Julie?
We are. When you look at, you know, everyone says we're headed toward a recession. When you compare what this recession is likely to look like from a jobs and employment standpoint to the one in 2008, it's really like apples and oranges. In 2008, you know, everybody was afraid for their jobs. There were layoffs everywhere, and they weren't just layoffs of people who were mediocre performers. Companies really cut into the muscle, and we are in a completely different place now. 14 years later, we have a new generation in the workforce. We have a lot of boomers that have retired in the last 14 years, and COVID sped that up. And so our collective attitude about work is different. The numbers are different. There are fewer people than there were then who want to work in corporate-type jobs, and we have a mismatch. So if we have X number of open jobs, and then we have X not, let's say we have, you know, make up numbers here, 5 million open jobs and 5 million unemployed people, that's not a one-to-one match. And so there could be, of the jobs open, just a great lack of people with the skills to fill those jobs. And so, you know,
I see what you're saying. So, like, if there are 10 jobs, I see. So if there are 10 jobs open at a radio station and only 5 of them are hosts, like on-air hosts, but you've got 10 people who want that job, it doesn't mean you give 5 of the jobs that are not on-air talent, you know, production jobs or sales jobs. I see what you're saying. It's not an equal 10 for 10. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
No. And, you know, and when you talk about, like, what do employers do when there's a recession looming? And it's exactly what the journal's saying, which is there are fewer job openings or job postings out there, because the first thing companies do is start pulling back job postings, because they're like, okay, so we're going to tighten our belt. We had these postings pre-approved to fill. We're not going to fill them now. And so that is always in the numbers. Then the next step is get rid of people who are underperforming or who are in departments where maybe, you know, we've maybe gotten a little fat and we need to maybe thin that herd a little bit. And maybe, right, and maybe we'll put the resources that we had in that department over here in a different department. And so there aren't enough people to fill the jobs, number one, there aren't enough people with the right skills to fill the jobs available, it will impact the kind of recession we have. And so, you know, but like everything, Melissa, you know, it's not one size fits all, because some of the people, you know, they say, you know, should you change jobs in a time like this? Well, it depends on what your field is. If you're in a job that's pretty dicey and not recession proof, you might want to get ready to do a job search, but hang on, kind of watch what happens. But if you're in a job where there continue to be, you get calls from recruiters, there's, you know, tons of postings, you know, you're getting approached on LinkedIn by companies, then, yeah, I mean, if you're miserable where you are, it can still be a really good time to change jobs. And that's not going to change for quite a while for a lot of professions.
So, Julie, it's interesting because I've heard from a lot of my friends that since COVID, their jobs have gotten a lot harder. So, for example, I have a friend who's a social worker. She used to work in an office of 5 people. It's now down to 2. She's essentially taken on 3 jobs for her one.
Yeah.
No pay change, no, you know, no real adjustment in any benefits to her taking it on. But it's been kind of, I'm going to say it's been presented to her as, hey, at least you're staying employed. What and I think a lot and I've heard, but here's the thing though, Julie, like believe it or not, a lot of people have been presented with that, like, hey, listen, you know, we only have this one job available here, and if you don't want it, I'll certainly give it to somebody else if you feel like this is too much to handle. Almost like a, I don't know if it's bluffing or if in fact it really is like, hey, you know, this is the way we're going. And if you don't want to take on three jobs, then we will find somebody else because we have no intention of going back to a five-person office. Does it make sense what I'm asking you?
Yeah. And so that was very common in 2008. And even when we started to come out of the 2008 recession, so I always say the whole employee relations strategy of organizations with the recession of 2008 was, don't like it? Go ahead and leave. There's a bunch of people lined out the door. And in that case, there probably were. In this case, there isn't.
But there's really not. Right.
No.
So would you recommend, so what would you recommend to workers like my friend, who again is a social worker, who basically, you know, was put into a task of, hey, we're going to keep you employed. We're going to keep you on board, but we're eliminating three people from this office. So you have now taken on their jobs. What do you suggest she do? Like a situation like that?
Look for a new job. Look, doing three people's jobs is untenable. It is not serving her clients well. It's not, she's going to fry. This is what happens. Your very best people get piled on. And if they have, let's say they've had a couple open positions for a while and haven't filled them, that would be another clue that they can't fill them. And so when we're in a place like this where there's still a lot of unfilled jobs, for people who are looking to change careers, if you do it in a smart, thoughtful way, this can be a good time to change careers. Mm. And if she's like, man, you know, I can't keep doing this, because on top of that, not only is she doing more than one job, but her clients are probably increasingly stressed out. And so the pressure,
right, because she's
on
not
her,
the same quality worker as she was prior to the shift. Yeah, that makes sense.
And so no, I mean, people like that, do not let your employer bully you into staying in a job that is harming your health, your relationships, et cetera, et cetera. There's always someone else out there who will hire you into a better role. And what employers are counting on in this situation is that you will believe them and you'll put your head down and work harder, and that you won't go out and look for something else. And Melissa, a lot of people don't go out and look for something else because they don't know why. Mm. And that's what we help people do, is figure out, how can you take what you know today and change directions with it? How can you take your skills and apply them differently?
Let's dive into that. So we're living in a very weird time right now where it's hard to navigate what's the best thing to do when it comes to your job. And we were just about to dive into jumping ship, which probably any employer listening right now is like, oh God, Melissa, don't give good advice. But I think it's really important, Julie, because as you mentioned, you know, we are seeing times that are kind of similar but very different from 2008, where you've got employers right now who are, you know, look, their backs are against the wall. COVID really messed up a lot of industries, and they had really good people either say, hey, you know what, I'm going to retire earlier than I planned, or I am not comfortable coming in the office anymore, or, you know, I'm going to stay home because I'm getting money from the federal government and I'm going to save, you know, to be able to watch my kids, not pay for daycare, whatever the case may be. Employers have been struggling in many sectors to get good workers to fill their positions. But in the meantime, on the other side of things, employees in a lot of sectors are struggling because they are now piled on with more work than what initially was given. And I will give an example, and this is not to call out my employer because I'm very happy with the job that I have. However, when I started this job, this was a two-man show. And during the pandemic, because of job cuts, we lost 15 people at my station, one of which is my co-host. And I have been solo on this show now for 3 years. So we've seen shifts in many different sectors. Now, some have been able to adjust, like myself. Others, not so much. So what would be your advice for jumping ship if you feel like you're being taken advantage of by your employer?
The first thing you absolutely have to do is figure out, what is it that's not working where you are? So is it just the amount of work? Is it the type of work? Is it, you know, is it the culture where you work? Is it your manager and the leadership style? So one of the biggest mistakes people have made over the last year or so, when the market has been so hot, is they have jumped without thinking about it. So they just changed jobs because they were getting recruited, and it feels really good. But what they didn't do was figure out what wasn't working where they were, and then try to then improve that in their next move. What a lot of people did was they jumped for money. And I get it. It's really tempting. But if your problem is the job you're doing, you're really burnt out on it. If you go to another place and you're making 10% more, you're still going to be burnt out on it. You're just going to be paid better, and you're going to be held. You're going to be held down. It's going to be harder for you to leave.
And you may not like the job you're doing. For the record, you may just because for more money. Yeah. I always say, like, money only buys you so much happiness. If you're still miserable coming home from work, then you've accomplished nothing. In my opinion,
yeah, that's true. And so figure out what is it that is your next best move. And we're afraid sometimes to think about it. I always say, what's your perfect 10? What would that look like? What would you do every day? What would you not have to do? What would be on your desk? Who would you work with? Which of your skills would you be using? And so figure out, if you're going to move from job A to job B, what do you want to improve? And then figure out, where might you get that? So when you look at just a really easy example, when you look at someone who's in social work, as an example, is your friend. She's probably a great listener, a good problem solver, has a lot of empathy, knows how to do a lot with a little. Those are just right off the top of my head. Well, maybe there's a role in human resources somewhere where they've got, HR has been decimated too. So maybe there's an employee relations job where those skills can be utilized. So you have to get really clear on what is it you're good at and what do you like to do, and then figure out. And this is why it's hard to do this on your own. I get it, which is why people go to coaches. Then you have to position yourself differently. And so your friend might say, I'm tired of doing the social work. I'm fried. What are some other things? Let me put my head up and look around. What are some other jobs that when I read the job description or the posting, they appeal to me? And those start to be those clues. And, so here's a great example, teachers. So for years, we would get calls from teachers saying, I'm burnt out on teaching. I really want to change careers. And we'd kind of be like, ugh, because it was really hard to get corporations to see teachers as anything but people who stand in front of a classroom of kids.
Right.
Well, guess what? Teachers have started to be recruited now. Corporations have started to say, teachers do have some skills we can use.
They're amazing communicators. They're incredibly patient. Yep. They're very oriented to their customer. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so true.
And so corporations, because they've been forced to think outside of that narrow box or that narrow world they've been living in.
Wow.
Like, that's why we're seeing in a lot of jobs, college degrees aren't required anymore.
Yeah, I've noticed that too.
Because they looked at it and said, what if we open this up? We can then attract people in rural areas. We can attract more women and minorities who a lot of times don't have those degrees, or people in rural areas,
which
I've disadvantaged.
I got to be honest, Julie, I'm glad that that's kind of not a thing anymore, only because A, college is so expensive, but B, I always found that you get way more experience. Like, it drove me nuts how many jobs I got passed up on as a young reporter, like over an Emerson student. And it used to drive me crazy because I'd be like, all right, so they went to a journalism school, but like I did mass communications. I worked at a television station since I was 18 years old. Like, internships, doesn't that matter more than the fact that I went to a journalism school, which I did not? So I'm glad that that's not the thing anymore, is the college degree. And where did you get it? I mean, I am glad that we're kind of getting away from that. So in some ways, it's good. It's good the way that things have changed a little bit, but it's that's really interesting. And I think that you touched on something, Julie, which is one of the biggest things people can do is to get a coach, is to find somebody who can kind of help them navigate and figure out what would be their next leap if this isn't working.
Yeah, it's an investment. It's an investment to hire a coach, but you're worth it. And it will pay back dividends over and over again.
Of course.
Because, the reason why everybody has a coach, including professional athletes, is because a lot of times people see things in us we don't see in ourselves.
Exactly.
I always say, hey, Melissa, I could write your resume all day long, but you tell me to sit down and update mine. I'm going to say, aren't there some toilets that need cleaned? I mean,
you're going to be like, I don't know anything about myself.
Good.
Yeah, it's true. It's very, very true.
We're terrible at it.
Yeah.
And therefore, we generally downplay our skills and our capabilities, and where we just sort of, especially women, as women, I think we do this much more. And so therefore we are missing out on opportunities that really are there if we just worked a little harder and pointed at something we cared about.
Very true. Julie Bauke, I love having you on the show, a career strategist, and I know you'll be back on very soon. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Melissa. Have a great day.
You too. Julie here on WICC. New overnight, Snapchat, the very popular social media app, is rolling out parental controls, allowing parents to see their teenagers' contacts and then report to the social media company, but it's without their child's knowledge. In the meantime, though, it's a little bit of a middle ground because they are not able to see the messages their kids are sending out, nor can they tap into the conversations audibly that they are having via either video messages or audio messages. It's really so that parents can see who their kids are in touch with and sort of go back to those days, at least when I was growing up, where, you know, the classic, my mom would say, I need to call their parents before you go to their house. It's sort of that idea of like a middle ground that Snapchat has created to get parents more involved with their kids' online worlds, but also to still allow a little bit of privacy for the kids to have. And joining me right now is Krista Karn. She's our social media consultant. Would love to get her perspective on this idea. Krista, what's going on?
Hey, yeah, I thought this was kind of interesting. You know, I think it bodes well for the industry that they are, you know, that they're coming out with new ways to address, you know, what's the kind of the scariest aspect to me of social media for parents, at least. You know, this is technology that we didn't have growing up and, you know, didn't exist not very long ago. So how it's influencing them. I mean, we can see in some ways, I think, how it influences them when they come home with crazy, you know, TikTok memes and they're singing funny songs and you don't understand where they get them from. So it's a whole different world. But I think this is a way to connect. And I did read the news that I do think that the teen has to agree to it. So you're not, you know, surreptitiously monitoring the connections, but they have to opt in to allow the parent to see who the contacts are. And I do think that that's a really interesting point because, you know, knowing who is talking to your kids and who your kids are talking to, I think is really step one, you know, for all social media monitoring and social in real life monitoring. Like, we want to know who our kids are hanging out with. Mm-hmm. And this creates an opportunity for that conversation.
So as I'm reading this article, and if you want to read it, it's on NPR this morning. It says, if your teen is headed to the mall, you might ask, who are you going with? Is it someone on your sports team? Do you go to school together? And you may not get the answer right back. So what this allows parents to do is to see who they are maybe sitting with at the mall, but they cannot listen into their conversations. It's that idea of where they can't see the content that their teens are sending or receiving on Snapchat, but at least they know who they've been in touch with within a 7-day period. And, you know, there's a couple of things I really like about this. As you mentioned, Krista, it's a nice middle ground because, you know, for me, I think the thing that is scary as a parent, more so if I had a daughter, I don't know why I'm not as scared about it with sons, and maybe that makes me sexist, I don't know. But I think the thing that worries me about daughters is online predators. You know, I worry so much about if young women are being, you know, called out by somebody on social media, you know, oh, you're so beautiful and yada, yada, and we should meet up. You know, you hear about these stories in news all the time. And typically it is for younger women that you see it. And that's an opportunity where if you as a parent, you've got a great relationship with your daughter or your granddaughter or your niece, or I guess we'll throw guys into it as well. If you have a great relationship with your kids and you see a contact on there and you're like, gee, this doesn't, I don't know who this is. And then you report it, which it sounds like you can report it to Snapchat and go, hey, I don't recognize this contact. I don't know who it is. They reached out to my kid and I don't feel comfortable about it. And they confirm that, hey, this is somebody who's, you know, a 40-year-old man who lives out in Arkansas. And it's like, well, then what the heck are they doing messaging my child? I think there's something really comforting about that, to be able to question it, especially if your kid doesn't come up with a good answer. And like I said, as a kid, you know, our thing in my day was instant messenger. I'm from the MySpace days. I wasn't even allowed to be on MySpace, but we had instant messenger. And my mom, notoriously, every Friday would come downstairs, look at our computer, and read through all of our friend contacts. And if we couldn't immediately tell my mom who they were and also remind her if they met the parents at all or if she had crossed paths with them, she made us delete them. Like right away. Mm. So it kind of brings me back to that where, you know, we had a good enough relationship with our mom that we were like, yeah, sure, check our list. And you know, and she would delete people that she didn't know. And you know, if they came back on our list, you know, that next week they were deleted again. So it reminds me a lot of that, where it is kind of a middle ground, but it also allows you to have a little bit of autonomy with your messages.
Well, and I think that because that, it sounds like she established a family expectation and a family rule. And like, I have a similar one with my kids. They're almost 14 and 12. If I don't know, if I can't call those people's parents, you know, assuming that they're all kids, or I don't have them as a contact in my phone or their parent, I don't want you to have that. I don't want you online with them. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And communicating. And I think, when you establish that early on and you establish that as a rule, then that's the expectation. So, you know, I think that, and this just helps reinforce that. I do think that there is some nefarious actors out there. And I think sometimes, you know, you can find a kid can get into deep, and you do hear stories about that. But I don't think monitoring is something that should be questioned. Do you know what I mean?
Especially when you're the one paying the phone bill. I'm sorry, and maybe this is me just getting older, but I never understood where there's any leverage. I understand giving your kids privacy. Look, I too was a teen girl at one point, and there was nothing I hated more than if my mom, you know, could read my text messages on the home screen. You know, she didn't have to open them up, but I absolutely was that person that immediately, as soon as the iPhone gave you, or I didn't have an iPhone, what am I talking about? When they gave you the option on the flip phone to change it from reading your text message to just saying, you got a new text message, I couldn't have done that faster, because there was nothing I was more terrified of than if my mom would just look at my telephone and see that I got a new message from my boyfriend or whoever, and she's starting to read the message. Because she can without that drove me nuts, you know? Like, I get it.
Like, I feel that's a violation. It's no different than if you had a journal or a diary and your mom decided to read it, whether she read it in front of you or read it secretly. Like, only in the most extreme circumstances would that breach of trust, I think, be required.
I agree. And,
you know, so I think that's part of the conversation. And I think that's the larger story here, is that we have to, as parents who are not, you know, maybe not digital natives, or, you know, I mean, the technology has changed so much just in the last 15 years, we can't be afraid of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of parents who tap out, who like, I just can't wrap my head around it. It feels like too much work. I'm just going to trust in the world, you know? And
it's a good point.
That inclination,
yeah.
But I just think that there's a lot of information out there. There's resources. I mean, if you go to that article on NPR, or if you want to post it later, whatever, Common Sense Media has people. There's organizations out there that are dedicated to creating more, you know, safer environments and educating, because once you know, you know. I mean, if I was able to track, see who my kid's talking to on Snapchat, and I finally download Snapchat, God help me, I could go follow those people that are following, right? I could follow those people that they're following without, I don't need his permission to, I don't need my kid's permission to do that. And then I can really see the content that he's maybe receiving.
I see what you're saying. So there's a clear difference between monitoring your kids and encroaching on their privacy, which is what you're getting into.
And I think it starts with being forthright about it. A, I pay for the phone. I pay for the phone. Anytime I want to look at it, there should be no reason that you don't hand it over.
Right.
But here's what I promise you, like a contract.
Yeah, like an agreement. Krista, you were just about to talk about how parents are... typically, your adults just in general are kind of afraid. They're intimidated by technology. A lot of times people don't even realize they have this tool, these abilities to have parental controls, and they just bypass them. They're like, you know what, I'm just going to – and look, I'm all about trusting in the Lord. I am too. But like, you know, I always tell the joke about how there, you know, is – and I'll get into it later, but, you know, the nun who falls into the ocean and like all the boats keep coming by, and she's like, oh, the Lord will provide. And then, you know, when she unfortunately passes away. She goes to heaven and she's like, God, where were you? And he's like, I sent you 6 boats. You didn't get on any of them. So mentality.
Well, yeah,
like, you know, you could trust in the universe all you want, but if you've got some help out there, you know, take it. Take the help. The parental controls are there. But people are intimidated to even research that.
Well, I mean, when I was growing up, you know, we didn't even have seatbelt laws, and we certainly didn't have bike helmets and stuff. So like, you know, like there's enough out there to show that, you know, to say that, you know, these are, you know, kind of necessary steps in parenting. And I don't think they have to be extreme. And I wonder a lot, you know, you're sitting around with your, you know, adult friends and who are parents and, oh gosh, my kids spend so long on devices. I can't wait to get them off. Like some days, you know, they just, you know, it was raining today and all they did was be on their devices. And like, yeah. And I used to watch binge, you know, TV and, you know, I mean, I would spend hours and hours and probably some pretty inappropriate things if I'm to be honest, you know, not age appropriate because I had every cable channel available to me. Right. So,
right.
You know, I think you have to just be realistic. And I mean, at the bare minimum, you know, do you have content settings on your kids' devices? So age gating and, you know, every device has basic parental controls and content controls so that they don't see sensitive content, explicit language and things like that, depending on what your values are, right? I mean, some of this is values-based. And I think, I mean, we've talked about this in the past, like, you know, there's a lot of content out there that can get around those, but at least as a starting point, that's one. And then I think you have to take your time and educate yourself because it's not, you know, they're designed for kids to use. So theoretically, it's not hard to figure out, but you do have to, like, I think take some time, like, you have to dedicate a day.
You have
to
dedicate time. I think that's, I hear exactly what you're saying, which is, you know, because I will be honest, like, sure, you know, you would think if kids can use it that it's easy, but I honestly struggle. I got to be I struggle. I struggle with it.
I'm not asking you to make a TikTok.
Don't ask me to make a TikTok because it's not going to happen and I still don't get it. So don't do that to me, Krista. But what you're saying, which I think makes sense, is you've got to, you know, look, if this is what's important to your kid and you want to get into your kid's world, and even if you have a semi-good relationship, but you feel like, I want to know who they're talking to. I want to know who is the most important people in my kid's life right now. Research what they're doing. You know, research Snapchat, learn how to do it. I mean, and I think, like you said, you don't have to use it actively. You certainly don't have to tell your friends, I'm on Snapchat. You know, like, you don't have to do that. But I think just to know as much as you can about your kid, I think that makes sense. I think what you're saying makes sense.
And under a certain age, I mean, like, you know, I mean, theoretically, kids are not, I mean, Snapchat's going to say, well, they're not supposed to have an account until they're 13 anyways. Now, a lot of people don't. You know,
don't follow that. Yeah. No, they don't.
Yeah, they don't follow that. But I think talking about the same way you wouldn't let your kid walk into like a rated R movie at age 8, probably, or at least, like, you know, you're not going to let them see something crazy.
Right.
You know, you may have researched it. Maybe you look and, you know, but I think it's the same sort of thing. So by having those conversations with the kids that there are limits and, you know, And it's also about helping them, I mean, and this is a longer game for sure, but like helping them identify, hey, listen, like if you ever see something online that you think that mom wouldn't want to see, that's an indication to not that you've crossed that you need to get off of that or block that person or, you know. And
yeah, I think so too. I think it opens up. I think it makes it more relatable because I find it's very hard to have a conversation with your kids about something they can't relate to. So if you see something on the news, for example, and you're like, you know, this happened, you know, in this state and it was horrible and it's awful and you need to tell me when this comes up and they're like, no, okay, I have no idea what you're talking about and why you're freaking out. But if you're saying, you know, hey, you've got this friend here. I don't even recognize who they are. Can I tell you why it makes me uncomfortable that I don't know who they are? And it opens up that conversation where they can understand a little bit better versus using something that they have no recollection about or it's nothing that they can really relate to, but they can understand it, I think, a lot better. I think this is not a bad thing. I think these are nice parental controls. I'm giving Snapchat a thumbs up. That's what I'm doing. Giving it a thumbs up right now.
Yeah, and I think it's only, we've talked about this before. I think it's only going to, you know, they're only going to get better and more. And at some point the government will get involved and make sure.
We're headed that way.
This has been
for
a
sure.
For all. So, you know, and just teaching them that it's all to keep them safe.
Them
and
safe
it's
at
like
the end
a
of the day.
Helmet.
Absolutely. Exactly.
It's just like a-
Exactly. It is like a bicycle helmet. Krista, if people want to ask you questions directly, how can they find you?
Twitter at KristaCarnes22, or you can email me, Krista@KristaCarnes.com.
Krista, I love talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, girl. Have a good day.
You too. Krista Carnes here on WICC. It is National Farmers Markets Week, and I wanted to highlight the many farms we have here across Connecticut. Joining me now is the Commissioner of the Department of Agriculture, Brian Hurlburt. Welcome back to the show, Brian. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well. How are you today?
Oh, I'm great. Anytime that we can talk about good news and stuff that's great about Connecticut, and particularly in my case, I love talking about farms. It's just my heart. I'm very happy. So I'm glad to have you here. So thank you.
Good. Good. Thank you.
Let's talk about National Farmers Market Week. And I know, you know, look, I think sometimes we have these national weeks or holidays and people are like, oh, it's not a real thing. But when you have weeks like today, or I should say this week, I think it's a great opportunity to highlight something that maybe a lot of people don't know about. How many farms do we have here in Connecticut?
Well, thank you for that question. And I always like to start off these conversations by just reminding people about the size of the agricultural industry in Connecticut. We have 5,500 family farms that employ over 21,000 people across the state and generate $4 billion to the state's economy. So, you know, that's a lot of farms. And, you know, we think about it, oh, there's a farm here. I do a corn maze over there. This is where I get my apples. So everybody thinks about it kind of in one-offs. But when you aggregate the entire industry, it's a pretty sizable chunk of the state's economy. And, you know, they're providing food and jobs to people. I mean, this is, you know, this is pretty great.
And Brian, I always forget this factoid, but the very first time you came on my show, you had said something like people don't realize, and I know I'm going to get this wrong, so please correct me as soon as you can, as soon as you pick up on what I'm talking about. I think you said something like 30% of our products go to like the country or something. How much of Connecticut's farm goods is distributed out? I can't remember, but you've told me it before, and I always botch it on the air.
So a lot of it stays in the state, but our milk does go out to be processed in some places, then come back in, because we don't have a lot of processing of capacity for milk in the state. But a lot of it stays in, and that's why the farmers markets are so important, because it's that direct connection with Connecticut shoppers and consumers. Where people can meet their farmer, understand what's going on at the farm, and have that conversation, pick up some, you know, new things that they may not have ever seen before, had a chance to try before, put it in their bag, ask the farmer, you know, what do I do with this? You know, garlic scapes are my go-to example. You know, what do you do with garlic scapes? You can, you know, you can saute them like green beans. You can chop them up and add them to a soup or to, you know, a stir fry. You can use it basically as a you know, a light garlic. So like little things like that just kind of make cooking a little bit more interesting.
And I don't know how to articulate this correctly, which probably sounds awful since my job is to talk for a living, but I never know how to describe to people the difference in food quality when you go to a farm. So,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I have a one of my best friends, you know, lives a couple towns over from me. She and I, you know, we tend to run into each other at the grocery store on the weekends because we got to feed our families. And in the last couple of weeks, she's like, Melissa, I haven't seen you. What's going on? Did you change your day for going grocery shopping? And I said, no, you know, something that I've been wanting to do since I moved to Connecticut, because as you know, Brian, and a lot of my listeners know, I lived in Vermont on and off for almost 10 years. And the one thing that we always did was we never walked into a commercial supermarket. My husband and I only did farmers markets or trips to the farms, and we went to meat markets. We never went to a commercial a chain. And so when I came to Connecticut, that was something that was really missing. And then you know, the pandemic kind of threw things into a weird place. But I started getting myself back into my routine of, like, I go up to Guilford now at least once a week to go to Bishop Orchards, and then I'll go, you know, to the farmers market in Milford, or I'll go to the one in Bridgeport. And my friend the other day is like, I don't know why you spend the extra money to, like, drive all the way to Guilford, or why you would spend extra when you could just get a bushel of kale, like, at Big Y or whatever. Nothing against the big commercial supermarkets. But I tried to explain this to her and so many other people. There is something about farm to table that just, it tastes so much better. And it is so worth spending the extra gas money or the extra money to buy their farm locally made like goods. I don't know how to describe it though, but I feel like this is your bread and butter. Literally, this is what you do. So maybe you could describe it better. I don't know how to describe it to people though. It's just so much better. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you get a whole experience, right? So, you know, when you're grocery shopping, it seems like a chore, an errand. And you're absolutely right. You know, our grocery stores, they have a role, they play a spot. And quite honestly, they buy a lot of Connecticut grown goods. They really try to bring in local products. But when you're at the market, you know, there's something about having a tomato on your sandwich that was picked, you know, that day. You know, or dicing up a cucumber that, you know, was just rinsed and then put out to you know, for sale and wasn't stored or processed or, you know, kept in a refrigeration, unit for too long. And, you know, it's tough to describe. So I think the best way to help them, your friend through this process is to offer to take her with you. And say, all right, you know, you just hop in the car. Then you don't have to spend the gas. It's not your time. We'll have a little, you know, a little quality time. And then check it out with me. And then she'll do it on her own. I can almost guarantee it because
I feel the same way.
You know, there is something there that, you know, and getting stuff, again, like you might not get at the grocery store. Or you might say, like, oh, I haven't done something with this in a while. And I do the cooking in our house, you know, trying to find something that the kids will eat that you haven't had 14 times already, you know, that is a little bit of a challenge. And so by going to the market, you can get a little bit more inspiration, say, all right, I haven't done anything with this in a while. Or, oh, yeah, that's a great, you know, recipe. I should try that. And a lot of farms, and you know, put out recipe cards.
Yes, they do.
Or if you just ask them, they say, hey, what instead of sauteing, you know, yellow squash, what do you think I should do with it this time? And they'll tell you. And it's great. You know, it's and the recipes are almost always very easy. They don't require, you know, 96 ingredients and, you know, a commercial oven. You can make it work pretty simply.
And you know, I'm glad you brought that up, Ryan, even the kids, because so I have a four-year-old and Chase is a pretty picky eater, to put it. We call him Picky Mickey. And he just is very difficult when it comes to mealtime. And I have noticed since going back to farm fresh food in the last month, corn on the cob. All of a sudden, can't have a meal without corn on the cob. Green beans. What did he have last night? Quinoa. Like, what in the world? I mean, like, the most random foods that I'm like, what? I can't even get you to have a hot dog. Like, what? I don't understand what's going on. It's really amazing. You are inspired as a cook, if you will. Like, I'm more inspired to cook. But also, my kid wants to eat the food. It's really unbelievable. It's like magic. It's magic. I don't know. It's the best way I can put it. It's magic. I don't know.
Well, and that's, you know, one of the nice things about going to a market is, you know, when you go to the grocery store, sometimes bringing your kids can be a little bit of a hassle, you know, because you're focused on what you need to do.
Right.
And, you know, the list and, you know, figuring out where that sale item is or, you know, do they move it from aisle 6 to aisle 9? You know, all those things that we do in the grocery store.
Right.
In the market, it's a little bit more of a relaxed atmosphere. You know, you can bring your kids. They can have fun. I love bringing my kids. They talk to the farmers. They ask what's going on. You know, it really improves their understanding of, you know, where our food comes from and who's growing it and what are the challenges and what are people doing out there. And that's a great thing. You know, we have a lot of programs, you know, especially our Farmer School program where we partner with other organizations. To try to make that connection. But we can do it on our own just by doing our grocery shopping at a farmer's market.
Yeah, it's very true. Just a word of caution, if you do bring your kids to a farmer's market or to one of the shops that's on property at a farm, just beware of the apple cider donuts, let me tell you. Because the last two times I have taken Chase with me to the farmer's markets, the cider donuts, good Lord. He's like, Mom, we got to get them. Got to support the farmers. I'm like, you're getting too smart for me. Joining me is Brian Hurlburt, who is the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture. I mean, cider donuts are great, but my gosh, I can't keep eating them because I'm just going to be the size of this room. Now, Brian, besides talking about farmers markets this morning and supporting our farmers, first of all, before we switch gears, what is the website one more time? If people want to find, there's literally like a list where people can find in their own counties, where there are farm stands, where there are markets happening. growing, how long they're going on for, what kind of farms there are. There's like an entire map and everything. Where can people go for that?
ctgrown.org. Go there, check it out. And like you said, you can search by town, by county, by area you want to be. If you're planning a weekend trip and on the other side of the state and you want to see what else is out there, you can find a farm stand, a farmer's market, their hours, what they offer, whether or not they take SNAP or other nutrition assistance programs, and make a trip of it.
Yeah, it really is great. And I will let people know, because that was a question I got earlier this week, is how long do the farmers markets go to? A lot of them go till the end of October, even early November. And then some do indoor markets as well. So don't just think because the summer is coming to a close that the markets go away. That is definitely not the case. In fact, I would argue the fall is one of their biggest profit makers, I would think, because you've got the pumpkins, the apples, pick your own, all of that. So definitely ctgrown.org.
From here on out, we're on a sprint. So, ctgrown.org is where people can find all that information. Go check it out. And again, there's, you can get inspired by seeing, what's going on the farms, what's happening out there, and figure out, maybe you'll try something different or pick up, a different product this week.
Yeah. If there's anything that I can get behind 110% and I don't need an advertiser check or anything like that, I will talk about farms all day long. I could talk to you, Brian, for the next week. But I will say, Brian, before I have to let you go, I did notice you were in Fairfield this week. What were you doing down here?
Yeah, we were down there yesterday to celebrate the release of the Connecticut Shellfish Restoration Plan. And this was pretty unique when you think about bringing people together and the heritage of Connecticut's aquaculture industry. We had obviously the Department of Agriculture, our Bureau of Aquaculture. We had the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. We had UConn Sea Grant. We had town shellfish commissions. We had the Pew Charitable Trust. We had the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. We even had a number of state legislators, local state legislators, Kristen McCarthy-Vahey and Representative Leeper. And then Joe Gresko, who's the chair of the Environment Committee from Stratford, came over to talk about, the future of Connecticut's oyster production and what we need to do in order to make sure that it is as strong and as beneficial not only to us as eaters, but to Long Island Sound and the ecosystem for hundreds of years to come. We are fortunate in Connecticut that we still have natural shellfish beds. These are where oysters naturally occur. And what we've been doing and really needed to develop the plan to is how to restore those. So, people are probably out there thinking, like, what do you need to do to restore a shellfish bed in an intertidal river or something?
Yeah.
Well, silt comes in and covers the oysters. That can suffocate the oysters. And so those natural shellfish beds, we count on them to help provide more oysters in the Long Island Sound. So they release their spat. If they're covered with silt, they can't do that. If the oysters are covered with silt, the spat, as it comes through that intertidal exchange there, it can't find a place to land. Baby oysters, they kind of float through the water. They need a hard surface to land on to attach themselves to start growing. That's why you see a lot of oysters in clumps. So if you put oyster shell down or make oyster shell available, that means more oyster spat will settle, which means more oysters, which means they'll produce more spat, which means more oysters. So you're really moving in the right direction to increase the number of oysters in the Long Island Sound. And so we did this, through a couple of ways. We restore these natural shellfish beds. We suck everything up. Actually, we don't. We pay oyster operations to suck everything up, remove the silt, put the shells back down. We're also working on a shell recycling program. So when you're at a restaurant and you have a dozen oysters on the half there, that used to just be thrown away. Those shells are really important. And so now people are collecting them. They clean them. They dry them. They make sure that they are, in good condition, disease, bacteria free. And then they're put down along the shoreline in certain areas to provide that oyster habitat. And so what we were doing, we were celebrating the release of this plan. We're celebrating the partners that came in there. And we were celebrating how much time and energy and collaboration it took to make sure that our oyster industry is as productive as it has been historically.
That's amazing. What a cool partnership. I mean, is that that's something kind of out of the ordinary for the Department of Ag, no?
Well, it was a little bit out of the ordinary for all of us, quite honestly.
Yeah.
We had the Pew Charitable Trust there. I will say in my 3 years as commissioner, this is the first time I've done an event with the Pew Charitable Trust. But they're engaged in this because they want to bring oysters back to the East Coast and make sure that we have a strong habitat for oysters. And oysters, I call them, I say there's three E's to oysters. There's the ecosystem benefit, where they filter 50 gallons of water per day. So they're pulling nutrients out of the water. They're making sure that it's cleaner. They provide an environmental benefit. They provide coastal resiliency, because if you have oysters down on shorelines, it reduces shoreline erosion. And then the third E is the economy. We harvest those oysters and we sell them, and we have, jobs that, are associated with our aquaculture industry, which, there's 60,000 acres of worked lands in Long Island Sound. The largest farm in New England is an oyster farm.
Yeah, I read that on your website. I couldn't believe that. That's pretty impressive. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. Wow.
When we think, from micro to macro, when we're sitting there at a table eating an oyster or having a fried oyster roll or something, you don't think about, the scale and the macro of what are oysters, how do they get to your table, what do they mean for everything else. But it's really a fascinating segment of Connecticut's agricultural industry. It's been around for hundreds of years. So we're very fortunate to have that resource, which means we've got to be really careful about how we, manage it and make sure that it's available in a sustainable manner.
Brian Hurlburt, so great to have you on the show. Thank you for your time. And I know we'll talk again
soon. Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Melissa.
Yeah, no problem. Brian is the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture right here on WICC.